From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the romantic comedy Crazy Rich Asians, directed by John Chu. Also, the adventure drama Alpha stars Cody Smith-McPhee. It's directed by Albert Hughes in his feature directorial debut. And we'll hear what our critics think of Peter Berg's new action flick, Mile 22, starring Mark Wahlberg.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in the Emmy-nominated role as the 20th century's most influential painter. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series, natgeotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series, Barry, NPR claims it's the best new comedy on television. For your Emmy consideration, nominated for 13 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And I'm so pleased to have a pair of our great critics to join us throughout the course of the hour. Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick. Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic, with us as well. And we begin with Crazy Rich Asians, highly anticipated romantic comedy from director John M. Chu. It stars Constance Wu, Henry Golding, Michelle Yeoh, and Gemma Chan. It's based on Kevin Kwan's book, following native New Yorker Rachel Chu to Singapore, where she meets her boyfriend's family.
So your family is, like, rich?
Quite comfortable.
That is exactly what a super rich person would say. It's not a big deal, obviously. I just think it's kind of weird that I had no idea.
Crazy Rich Asians, Justin.
Yeah, that scene takes place while they're flying first class to Singapore, and this movie is kind of, I've described it as a tour de force of lifestyle pornography. I mean, it's just like, everything in this movie, it's just every frame is crammed with visual detail. And one of the ways in which I think it improves on Kevin Kwan's novel is that it's actually much better to be assaulted visually by all these luxury brands than to just read a list of them, which is, you know, a large chunk of what that novel's about. I really like this movie. And I say that, I know that's kind of, talking about this movie has become so loaded because it is representing so many things. I mean, so much has been written already about this is the first Hollywood studio production in 25 years since the Joy Luck Club to not only feature an all-Asian and Asian-American cast, be directed by an Asian-American, and to focus specifically on this kind of puzzle of Asian-American identity and all the complications.
And the source materials by an Asian-American writer.
Yes, exactly. So there are a lot of expectations riding on it. As an Asian-American myself, I cannot pretend to be entirely objective, but film criticism is never entirely objective anyway. So one tries to put that aside, and I enjoy this movie. It tries to do so many things, and I think it does do a lot of them quite well. You know, it's this very satirical view of this kind of the Singaporean Chinese 1% of the 1%, you know, just extreme, obscene, beyond your dreams, luxury and wealth. And it shows you that through the eyes of this kind of guileless New York Asian American person who may be marrying into the family, and the family is, you know, rejects her from the outset and sees her as a gold digger.
So she's the one who carries us in. She's the one we identify with throughout the story.
We identify with her and kind of her estrangement from this culture that she knows very little about. And it's a Cinderella story, and it's a satire, and it's a soap opera. It's kind of a meet the in-laws or potential in-laws comedy, all kind of wrapped up in this very gaudy kind of visual detail.
Christy, what do you think?
I loved it. And it's also a big, splashy, old-fashioned screwball comedy. And from the very beginning, from the opening titles, you get a blast of the big band score, and it's transporting to the kind of film that we saw like 70, 80 years ago. As Justin mentioned, the clothes, the homes, the settings, everything is so beautiful, and everyone's witty, and it's very much a throwback. But John M. Chu also balances beautifully a great contemporary vibe here, because the experience that Constance Wu's characters having between her identity as, you know, an American growing up in New York, and this tradition that she never particularly felt beholden to in any way. It's a fascinating inner conflict for her that I imagine a lot of folks probably also go through. She's trying to forge her own path, but also be true to her heritage. And yeah, I had a blast. And Henry Golding, who is Nick Young, the bachelor that she is dating, he is a straight up movie star. He is like old school Gary Cooper, Cary Grant. Like he looks the part. It's his first film. He was a TV travel host. He'd never been an actor before in his life. They have crackling chemistry. They are beautiful together. And it's a great supporting cast. Awkwafina as Constance Wu's best friend from college nearly steals the whole thing. Ken Jeong is her dad, who is also very funny. Nico Santos, who is the very flamboyantly gay member of the family. I want to see a whole series of Awkwafina and Nico Santos characters giving people makeovers.
You could fill this a series with this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the book is like 500 pages and it spawned two sequels. And I would say, you know, it's worth noting, you know, a lot of talk about diversity and representation. This cast is diverse in ways that go beyond purely just ethnic identity. You know, you have, as you, all those actors you just describe, you have very kind of broad comedians like Ken Jeong. You have, you know, a style icon played by the British Chinese actress and former model Gemma Chan, and you have Michelle Yeoh, who's been one of the, I think, great international movie stars of the past, you know, 20 years or more, playing the mother of Nick Young. And I think she gives, you know, the best and most dramatically substantial performance in the movie, because she's kind of, you know, setting this very hot, you know, very, very cold reception to the Constance Wu character, but you sympathize with her. I certainly did, because she's saying things about, you know, she's kind of like, you Americans are so individualistic. You pursue your own happiness and you have no regard for family and sacrifice and devotion. You can argue with that. I think a lot of viewers will, but it's really, there's something very powerful about hearing that articulated in a movie like this.
Yeah, she's a villain and a goddess, but you do see where she's coming from, and she's written far more complexly than you expect. Yeah,
absolutely.
The movie is Crazy Rich Asians, and in fact, we're going to talk more about it coming up later this hour on Film Week, the film and what it represents to more Asian and Asian American representation in films here. The movie's rated PG-13 and it's in wide release. Alpha is film stars Cody Smith McPhee. It's directed by Albert Hughes. The dramatic story of survival of a boy and wolf during the last ice age.
My father always told me survival is never certain. And when there are no more leaders to follow, you must become one.
Albert Hughes makes his directorial debut with Alpha. Christie?
So that clip you just heard was in English. This movie is not in English. This movie is entirely subtitled in like an ancient tribal language. It is set 20,000 years ago in Europe. This is the last ice age. So I'm impressed that you guys found a clip where we could actually listen to something we can understand, because the whole thing is subtitled. This is Albert Hughes, half of the Hughes brothers, who did Menace to Society and From Hell and The Book of Eli. This is his first film on its own. And it's very much an old-fashioned kind of like man versus nature story, but also a boy and his dog story. It is about this teenager who is the son of the tribal elder who is being trained to become a warrior and a hunter, but he doesn't really want to and ends up being abandoned and left for dead during a hunt. This wolf, who also happens to have been abandoned and left for dead by his pack, is hurt and right near him on the ground, and they look out for each other. And the movie sort of purports itself to be the origin of how dogs became man's best friend. I'm not sure this is exactly how it happened, but it's a really heartwarming and beautifully shot story. And there's such efficiency and quiet power in the storytelling here, because they convey so much just through the way the wolf and this boy interact with each other. It's a very old-fashioned story told with like really gorgeous high-tech visuals. I was very impressed and very surprised by this.
Well, I think it's a great concept for a film, because, of course, there was no one writing it down at that time when you know, wolves became domesticated as dogs. So the idea that you're sort of showing the origins of that is pretty interesting. What do you think, Justin?
Yeah, I agree with all that. It's a very sincere and very pleasing throwback to a style of filmmaking I don't think we see much coming out of the studio system, certainly. You know, old-fashioned wilderness survival story. You know, the fact that they do sustain this entirely fictional, I believe, language, you know, is pretty impressive. And Cody Smith McPhee plays the young man, and this is not his first time in a survival movie. He was like in The Road years ago. And just the visual majesty of this movie is really quite breathtaking. Even though you could quibble with some of the use of the CGI, there is definitely there are times when you see, of course, and nobody's going to give you it's hard to do these things practically, you know, and there's this amazing, you know, sequence at the beginning, and they repeat it, in fact, with this kind of, you know, they ambush a herd of buffalo while hunting. But just, you know, Albert Hughes, yeah, he has, you know, the Hughes brothers have an eye. There's no doubt about that. And you see, and I do recommend that you see this film in IMAX 3D if you choose to see it.
That's how we saw it. Yeah. And the biggest screen you can find. I will say it looks like it might be kind of a happy, sweet movie for kids. It's very violent. It's all right. Really bloody and really violent and very, very intense. But I think for kids maybe like 8 or 9 and older, it would be an excellent choice.
It is rated PG-13. The film is Alpha, Albert Hughes directing. Daniel Sebastian Wiedenhaupt is the screenwriter. Cody Smith McPhee stars in the film. It's in wide release. Mile 22, an action film from director Peter Berg. It stars Mark Wahlberg, Lauren Cohan, and Ronda Rousey. It's a film about an elite tactical unit that has to work with an American intelligence officer to smuggle a mysterious police officer with sensitive information out of the U.S.
Diplomacy is option one. Military is option two. When options one and option two are abandoned, there's only one thing left. Which is us. We are the third option.
Mile 22. What'd you think, Justin?
I think this could be the worst movie I've seen this summer and maybe even this year. You got some sense of it from the clip. That is Mark Wahlberg playing sort of the most obnoxiously Mark Wahlberg character in some time. You know, and I actually like Mark Wahlberg, you know, in his better vehicles. But imagine kind of his cop from The Departed, maybe less of the thick accent. Give that character some kind of dissociative identity disorder. All of his dialogue basically consists of rah-rah, American first, American exceptionalism, boilerplate, and you have this movie. Now, this is his latest collaboration, too, with the director Peter Berg. And I've, you know, again, I've confessed to kind of enjoying some of their, you know, their movies are incredibly macho, jingoistic, swaggering action and war movies like Lone Survivor.
I'm kind of surprised to hear you saying the word. I understand it not being very good,
yeah.
But it's like worst film of the summer. I mean, because Berg is a pro.
He is a pro, and there's this weird, but it's weird. This movie is basically a bloodbath that ensues when the CIA sends this team into a fictional Southeast Asian country to recover reserves of cesium that are being used for a possible terrorist attack. And he is an action pro. I mean, in films like Lone Survivor and Deepwater Horizon, you can't deny his chops, absolutely. Here, he seems to have kind of overdosed on Paul Greengrass pills. I mean, no shot in this movie is held, even in the dialogue scenes. I mean, he shoots a dialogue scene like a shoot 'em up, and you kind of just want him to slow down, hold a shot for longer than a second. I know this is kind of the trend in action movies nowadays, this kind of intensely kinetic, you are there kind of nonsense, but not everyone, again, can be
well,
Paul Greengrass.
Well, Greengrass does it.
He does it and
makes it, because I share your aversion to that approach, but somehow Greengrass pulls it off.
He pulls it off. It can be done well, and again, Peter Berg is not, you know, a bad director in this department, but I think there's just something about the way this is conceived. I found it excruciating. Even though it's only 87 minutes, it felt longer than that.
Christy.
Is it really only 87?
I'm pretty sure if I check the running time correctly.
Is this worse than Gaudi? It's bad for worst movie of the summer. So yeah,
that's
Gaudi
separate
would be
segment.
A little
worse.
More interesting than
right.
that, perhaps.
You were mentioning the other movies that Mark Wahlberg and Peter Berg have done together, and what makes set those apart is that they are coherent. Right, this is the way this is cut. Is crazy making. And yeah, as Justin mentioned, he will cut between faces during two people having a conversation as if it were a big action set piece. And why? What is the point of that? Is it to put us on edge? I don't know. And then he flashes forward to an interview that Wahlberg's doing with some dark ops person trying to explain how the operation went down poorly. So you've got that part of it too. Yeah. And also, Wahlberg's character is supposed to be like this genius whose brain moves so quickly that he has to repeatedly snap a yellow band on his wrist. So every 2 seconds between cutting between faces and gunshots, you hear snap, snap, snap. And it's insanely frustrating and tense and not in a good way.
Well, it almost sounds like an experimental film, the way you just
described
it.
I wish.
I would admire that impulse. I mean, in a way, if you're seeing this movie as shot from Mark Wahlberg's character's perspective, this kind of amped up way. I will say the best thing in the movie is the Indonesian actor and stuntman Iko Uwe, who you might remember from The Raid and The Raid 2, both of which are far superior action movies to this. And he is, you know, kind of the foil to Mark Wahlberg's character, and he's a star and amazing to watch and gives a great physical performance.
Yeah, but those big fight scenes also are cut so frantically that you can't appreciate his athleticism.
And John Malkovich makes an appearance.
He's their boss. Does. He's the guy who runs these shadowy operations. Yeah. And even he can't really liven this up just by showing up and being John Malkovich.
Ooh, good.
Thank you.
Extra points to Christy Lemire, Justin Chang with us. Mile 22, the action film, directed by Peter Berg. Leah Carpenter wrote the screenplay. Mark Wahlberg, Lauren Cohan, Ronda Rousey star. The film is rated R. It's in wide release. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Madeline's Madeline, a dramatic thriller. We'll also hear about Skate Kitchen and Minding the Gap. I have to tell you, the critics said on their way into the studio, it's a good week. So you want to stay tuned. A lot of good films. They're going to talk about recommendations for your weekend viewing. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We're back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us this week. Got some strong films we talk about with Christy Lemire and Justin Chang. Next up, the dramatic thriller Madeline's Madeline. It stars Helena Howard, Molly Parker, and Miranda July. Josephine Decker not only directed but co-wrote the screenplay. Justin?
This is one of the most interesting and, I think, adventurous independent movies of the year so far. It's very, the experience of watching it is by turns stimulating and baffling, even confounding, and yet by the end it achieves this sort of exhilarating sense of catharsis that it builds to. Josephine Decker is this is her third feature. She is a very unorthodox and really, really interesting talent, and this movie grew out of this collaboration with Helena Howard, who is this astonishing teenage newcomer. If nothing else, this movie is a showcase for this brilliant mercurial performance that she gives as Madeline, the 16-year-old New Yorker aspiring actress. The film moves between scenes of her difficult home life with her mother, who's played by Miranda July, and who's a very kind of sweet and fragile and not entirely understanding character, and these scenes of Madeline with this experimental theater troupe that she is, of which she's the youngest member of this company. And the director of that troupe is played by Molly Parker. And she loves Madeline. She fawns over her. But she seems to have this somewhat sinister, not entirely scrupulous agenda. That's the basic outline of the story. I mean, and yet it gives you almost no impression of what it's actually like to watch this movie, the way it's shot. She uses, you know, blurred edges. The shots are all kind of decentralized in some way. Weird sounds and voices kind of issue up from outside the frame. You feel it's almost like you're in this womb. It's a womb of a movie in a weird way. It's like this very abstract and yet experience that is nonetheless narratively coherent enough that you can follow it. The director, Jacques Rivette, who is one of her inspirations here, I think, once said that every movie is a documentary of its own making. And that's kind of, it's in a way, she's sort of, I know I'm making this sound impenetrable, but it's not really. You should go with it. You should see it. It's like, it's very much, this is a movie about her process in some ways. And she's sort of interrogating her own process in a lot of ways.
I'm so glad that Justin had the task of explaining Madeline's Madeline to you, because I'm not sure I could have done it. Yeah, I like that you mentioned that you feel like you were in a womb while you're watching this, because I think overall this is a film about motherhood, and it's about creation, and whether that is an artistic creation or how Miranda July is trying to be a mother to her daughter and having difficulty with it. There are some allusions to the daughter having had some sort of mental breakdown at some point, and they have a very fraught relationship. Meanwhile, Molly Parker, who is just frightening, insidious as this theater director, also serves as a mothering figure to her, even though she's pregnant herself with her own child. And it's about that tender and complicated emotional terrain. The sound design's really cool. Helena Howard is a superstar. She can be cat-like. She can be manipulative. She can be childlike. And she can just rage. And it all feels true and authentic and coming from a visceral, pure place. So I'm really excited to see what all the future holds for her.
Have you seen her in other
Never.
Films?
This is her first thing, I believe.
Oh, okay. And yeah. I think she was, you know, I believe that Josephine Decker discovered her a few years ago in an acting competition. And she was just so, like, moved to tears by this young actress that they formed a friendship and started working
see,
together.
See, that's the documentary about yes. the
makeup. Precisely. Absolutely.
Wow. So you're really high on this film too, Christy.
Well, I don't know that I am. I mean, I'm mixed on it. I'm talking to Justin has actually been very helpful because working through it, it's a movie you got
to
talk about
over.
Afterward. As I was watching it, I was fascinated by it, certainly never bored by it. It's very challenging, but I wasn't quite sure what I had seen. So it's a movie that, you know, and how often do films challenge us in that way? I welcome that. And so I'm happy to talk to my far more intelligent, astute colleague.
Not more astute. I had kind of a similar experience, I would say. And I did see it twice before writing about it because I had to. And sometimes you have to give, you know, and I do think it absolutely repays that attention, though.
I love the ending. Yeah. And
it's a gorgeous ending, too.
Yeah. It's thrilling. It's euphoric. Yeah.
Now you piqued my curiosity. Madeline's Madeline, a thriller at the New Art Theater. It's unrated. Josephine Decker co-wrote it with Donna Dean Novelli, Decker directing, and Helena Howard stars. Also this week, Skate Kitchen, a drama starring Rachel Vinberg and Dee Dee Lovelace. Crystal Moselle is making her feature directorial debut, and she co-wrote the screenplay. Christy?
This is one of two really excellent skateboarding movies we have. We're going to talk about them back to back. This is from a female perspective, and Crystal Moselle has been a documentary filmmaker, and that really shows in the intimacy of the way she tells this story. It mostly focuses on an 18-year-old named Camille, played by Rachel Vinberg, who sees this group of young female skateboarders on Instagram who are in New York. They skate in the Lower East Side, and they call themselves Skate Kitchen. In reality, there is a group called Skate Kitchen, and Rachel Vinberg is part of them. They all really are skateboarders, playing versions of themselves. And she sees them, and she's kind of lonely and kind of feels disconnected from the outside world. She lives at home with her mom in working class Long Island, and she dares to get on the train and go and find these girls and skate with them. And there's such joy when the first time she skates with them, I wanted to cry because like she's found her tribe and she's so happy. And the movie from there is basically just kind of a hangout film. It's hanging out with these girls and navigating what happens when there's a boy that a couple of them are both interested in, played by Jaden Smith, who is really good in this, you guys. He is. I think Jaden Smith was set up to fail in, I Am Legend? What was the movie?
After Earth.
After Earth, yes,
Will
thank
Smith
you.
And Jaden Smith.
He has a really understated presence to him here. But this film is really at its strongest when it's just hanging out with these girls. There's a wonderful kind of magic hour, dreamlike quality to the way it's shot. A lot of slow motion, a lot of long tracking shots, and yet a gritty kind of tangibility to the streets and the sights and the sounds of New York City. It's a cool balance she pulls off here.
Skate Kitchen,
yeah,
Justin?
It's, you know, everything Christy said. I mean, it's a reminder, as is Mind in the Gap and as are certain films by like Larry Clark and Gus Van Sant, that skateboarding, young people on skateboards, is one of the most inherently cinematic images, I think, that we've seen, you know. It's just, there is, you know, it's a very loose-limbed narrative. You know, it's a wonderful kind of ode to female friendship. You know, there's sort of the emotional dynamics come into play later where there's betrayal and resentment and there's some romantic rivalry that, but really this movie is about hanging out, finding your tribe, kind of thumbing your nose at the, in a male-dominated sport where they're like, you know, get out of the way, boys, you know, sort of there's this real energy to it, too. And yet also Crystal Moselle is just as observant and sensitive a director when they're not on their skateboards, too. There are sometimes scenes where, you know, there's a party or they're just hanging out, and you see that Rachel Vinberg's character, who is very assured and comes to life when she's skating, doesn't really know how to interact so much with people on a more, you know, just on a more conventional verbal level. So it's a really, really good film.
It's a great diverse cast too. All these skater girls, you know, playing themselves. I want to mention real fast, Nina Moran, who is the lesbian
hilarious
member of the group. She's so funny. She's just brash and crass and profane and steals every scene she's in. So yeah, I'm really happy this film exists for every kind of girl.
Skate Kitchen, rated R at the Arclight in Hollywood. The documentary Minding the Gap is directed by Bing Liu. Christy?
Here's your other skateboarding movie. And this is not quite so joyous, but it is as intimate and as emotionally powerful. So Bing Liu and two of his best friends, who he grew up with in Rockford, Illinois, have been skateboarding together since they were teenagers. And now they're like in their early 20s. But Bing Liu has been shooting footage of them all this time. And because he's a skateboarder too, he's right there with them, again, with the long tracking shots. He makes you feel like you are a part of the action, and you see them goofing around and joking with each other at the skate park or wherever. And it's the film follows them over the course of several years and how they try to navigate that transition into adulthood. The skating for all of them is their salvation. It's their escape. They all come from these horribly abusive homes. And it's how they do or do not pass on that cycle of domestic violence to their own families and how skateboarding helps them navigate it. That sounds really complicated. It's not. From a pure level, it's a character drama. It's a study of a small town that's deteriorating. And you feel like you truly are there among these people. And Steve James is one of the producers, and that makes total sense because it feels like the best of what he has done over the years in following characters in these true working class settings.
I'm impressed that someone who is a skateboarder and just starts sort of shooting this then has the filmmaking chops to make this compelling film. That's impressive.
He's telling a story he knows.
Yeah.
It's a good place to
Justin?
Start.
Well, it's true. I mean, there's this early shot in the movie where the camera like follows his two friends, and it goes underneath the boom gate of the toll booth and the parking structure, and you're like, how did he get that shot? And it's like, well, he's clearly a skilled skater and a skilled cinematographer, and I think that both of those things are hard to do well and to do them together. And I think he's also grown. I mean, you see some of this movie, there's a real sort of the feel of a compressed epic in this movie, because you know there are shots from when they were, I think, kids of like 8 or 9 or something, and alongside the more kind of recent footage. And what I love about the movie is that the skating is kind of the hook, but even more so, I think it's an interesting contrast with Skate Kitchen, not just because of the gender focus. This is very much a movie about toxic masculinity and cycles of domestic abuse. The skating is almost like just the launch pad into this much larger and very important conversation about kind of how we live now and what is it like in this sort of economically impoverished town where people are fleeing and where there seems to be no hope, and skating is this one refuge from your really, really, really messed up life.
And the skating falls away as the film goes along.
Yeah.
I mean, they
almost
do
doesn't
less
need
and
it.
Less of
I mean,
it.
It's beautiful. I could do it. I could see it. I could watch a movie with these guys just skating, but it almost puts that on the back burner.
Yeah. Bing Liu directs Minding the Gap documentary, which is unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. The Wife, a drama, stars Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce. Bjorn Rung is the director. Jane Anderson wrote the screenplay for Meg Wolitzer's book. Justin?
Yeah, the reason this movie exists, I think, is to showcase an astonishing and subtly riveting performance from Glenn Close. The rest of the movie doesn't always rise to her level, but she makes it much more interesting and persuasive than it would be otherwise. Close, she plays Joan Castleman, who's the wife of a renowned American author named Jonathan Castleman, played by Jonathan Pryce. And as the movie begins, you find out that he has just won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So most of the story takes place in Stockholm, and one of the fascinations of it is simply watching what it's like when you win the Nobel Prize. I don't know how that works exactly. I'm curious
you
to see what.
So
I'm looking forward. No, not at all. I am looking forward to the Slate article. You know what the wife gets wrong about the Nobel Prize. But you know it's you know as the Swedish Academy guides these laureates through a week of very kind of eccentric and very rigid rituals and public relations and all of that. And so you watch as the husband, the writer, soaks up all this attention. He's flirting with other women. He's eating too much. He's kind of a glutton. He's kind of this weak, arrogant man. And then the most interesting thing going on in this movie is entirely playing out in Glenn Close's face. You know, whether she's in the background of a scene or holding a close-up, her every expression is so piercing and conveys so much about what it is like to have been faithful and loyal for more than 30 years to a man who has consistently hogged the literary spotlight. And there are flashbacks throughout this movie, which don't entirely work, I think, although they're compelling in their own right. You know, because that she herself was a talented writer herself.
Christy?
Yeah, this is a riveting film, and Glenn Close is just subtly devastating. And she's known for scenery chewing, you know, and eventually she builds up to that. But the slightest facial gesture or wry smile says so much. She and Jonathan Pryce have amazing chemistry and great tension with each other. And yeah, and thankfully, though, there are these moments of absurdity when they're in Stockholm, the humorous moments of how crazy the Nobel situation must be, we'll find out someday. Who knows? But I liked it a lot for her.
The Wife stars Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce, Bjorn Rung as the director, Jane Anderson, the screenwriter. It's rated R. You can see it at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Coming up, we'll hear about more of the new releases of the week, and we'll also talk about the cultural significance of the film Crazy Rich Asians. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with LA Times film critic Justin Chang and Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick. Next up, Juliet Naked, a comedy drama starring Rose Byrne, Chris O'Dowd, and Ethan Hawke. Jesse Peretz is the director. Christy.
So Rose Byrne and Chris O'Dowd are a couple living in coastal England, this sweet little historic seaside town. And they're kind of happy. They've been together for a while. They don't have kids. If they don't want kids, they're happy. It's fine. Chris O'Dowd is obsessed with this long AWOL 90s singer-songwriter named Tucker Crow, played by Ethan Hawke. And he's like mysteriously just disappeared from the face of the planet. But there's this tiny little group of people who are still obsessed with him. And Chris O'Dowd is their leader. A new album from Tucker Crow comes out called Juliet Naked. And Rose Byrne listens to it and gives a very candid review of it. What do you know? Tucker Crow himself reaches out to her to say, you were dead on. And they begin this fun, flirty email friendship, and then they meet in person. I've decided that scruffy dad Ethan Hawke is my favorite Ethan Hawke, because he's got pathos to him and depth, and there's a sweetness but still like a hunkiness about him. And this movie is really charming. It's based on a Nick Hornby book, and it very much feels like that in terms of the obsessive nature.
So Hornby-esque.
It is Hornby-ish, yes, because it's about male obsession and the women who see through it and are smarter than them. And yeah, everyone's got lovely chemistry here. It's a charming lark.
All right, what do you think, Justin?
Yeah, I think this might be my favorite version of Ethan Hawke as well. Mm-hmm. First Reformed is. But this is a second place. I mean, he's kind of been working toward this, like in movies like Boyhood and Before Midnight, where you see that kind of the boyish, the kind of 90s star that he was, He becomes a grandfather in this movie, actually, because mm-hmm. he's had multiple marriages, multiple relationships, multiple children. I know.
You're blowing my head open here.
I know. And it's true. And yet, he's very, very good in that. And I think, you know, there's not really a weak link in this cast here, Rose Byrne and Chris O'Dowd, especially as the, this very, very sort of insufferable academic, pop cultural obsessive. I think it's the best movie that could be made from a premise that I don't really love, which is still this sort of, you know, I mean, Rose Byrne does a lot to make this character very, very engaging, and it is her perspective, but I'm a little the sane, down-to-earth woman having to deal with two overgrown man children in a way and dealing with their narcissism. It's charming and yet some reservations.
There's a 60s, like a retro cool 60s vibe that runs through this film that I like very much too, though, in terms of the interiors and the music. And yeah,
it's
charming.
Well designed.
It's
no
charming.
Question.
Yeah. Juliet Naked, a comedic drama. It's at the Arclight Hollywood, the Landmark in West LA. It's rated R. And the drama We the Animals is directed by Jeremiah Zagar, making his feature directorial debut. Evan Rosado and Isaiah Christian star in the film. Christy?
As with Skate Kitchen, we have a documentarian here making a narrative feature debut. So this is about these three little boys who are brothers living in kind of working class squalor in, I want to say it's Texas. They never specify, but it feels like Texas because it feels like a Terrence Malick movie to me in a lot of ways, in the best ways. And their parents are struggling to make ends meet, and they drink too much, and they fight too much. And it's how these kids kind of forage for themselves and survive on their own and rely on each other. And it's told in this really episodic, kind of wispy, impressionistic way. It's like a series of vignettes, and they're incredibly efficient in conveying who these kids are and what they're going through without spelling everything out. And it's dreamy and yet gritty at the same time. And when I compare it to Terrence Malick, it's because of the role that nature plays and how it shapes them and how integral it is in telling their story. But there's more of a narrative drive to it, and there's more of an emotional heft to it than with those films. Evan Rosado, who is the youngest of the three boys, who we mostly see through his eyes, is just, he's got this fascinating face and this purity to his presence, and he's our conduit, and you truly feel like you are among these people, whether you want to be or not. This is a deeply moving film and a beautifully shot one.
We're talking about We the Animals, Justin.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And one of the things that's very moving about it is you see these three brothers who almost seem to be like one entity at times. The way they move, the way they're running around shirtless most of the time, jumping in mud, hiding under a blanket, they're like almost like one single entity. And then what's very moving about it is you see that sort of split apart as they grow older and come into, and as the Evan Rosado character in particular comes into his own. This movie, in its sort of focus on poverty and identity and sexual awakening and other challenges of this existence, it kind of reminds you a little bit of The Florida Project at times, a little bit of Moonlight even. I don't think it's as accomplished as either of those two films. I think sometimes the lyricism maybe verges on a little bit too twee or forced.
Those are hard marks to me.
We are grading, two films. We are grading on a very high art house curve here. But it's a very, very beautiful and captivating debut nonetheless.
Yeah, and Raul Castillo and Sheila Van have great chemistry as the parents. They're both excellent in this.
We the Animals, drama at the Landmark West LA. It's rated R. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, or perhaps through the KPCC app or at kpcc.org.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue. The film profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and was created from over 100 hours of never-before-seen silent archival footage. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including exceptional merit in documentary filmmaking. Visit natgotv.com/FYC for more information.
And the HBO drama Game of Thrones. Time calls it the biggest and most popular show in the world. In the epic season 7 of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. The most Emmy-nominated program this year is nominated for 22 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Well, as you undoubtedly know from our lead-off review this week, Crazy Rich Asians is the big wide release of the week. It's big for multiple other reasons as well. It's almost all Asian and Asian-American cast, Asian-American filmmaker, the source material from an Asian-American writer, and it's a big studio film. Well, how much is riding on this, and what are the potential doors that this movie could open? With us to talk about it, Los Angeles Times film reporter Jen Yamato. Jen, good to have you with us.
Oh my goodness, you guys. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
So, Crazy Rich Asians, how big a deal is this for future potential Asian-American themed films?
Well, before we talk about the future, let's talk about the past. This is the first movie in 25 years on this scale to be told by a Hollywood studio with an all-Asian and Asian-American cast to be centered on an Asian-American story. It is monumental. The last one was 25 years ago with Joy Luck.
There was Memoirs of a Geisha, but that was a non-Asian director.
And you know what? I don't like to talk about Memoirs of a Geisha.
And the source material was non-Asian. But the cast was almost all Asian.
Sure. And, you know, this is a contemporary story. It's a normalized story. It's not some, like, historic period, you know, thing involving geishas or, you know, kung fu or anything like that.
And we've had South Asian films. A listener points out The Namesake, and there have been some others.
Yeah. In terms of Hollywood movies, this is potentially maybe not a game changer, because the game has been slowly changing, but especially on the back of Black Panther earlier this year, it could really blow the doors so much wider open than they have been in decades.
To me, one of the real keys is, how is the film going to play in parts of the country that have comparatively small Asian American populations? If this film, just because it's funny, it's entertaining, it looks great, attracts a broad audience, then studios would have to sit up and take notice.
Sure, and it should, and I hope it does, because Crazy Rich Asians is based on this 2013 novel by Kevin Kwan, which was an international bestseller, translated into 12 different languages. And he himself told me when I interviewed him, along with so many people from the cast and filmmakers, Kevin Kwan told me that his book would not have been the success it was if only Asian people read it. Mm-hmm. And the same is going to have to be true for the movie. I think it's certainly a movie that doesn't solely appeal to Asian audiences or Asian American audiences, or very specifically Chinese American, Singaporean audiences whose stories are more closely, you know, like aligned or reflected in this very specific slice of the world that is seen on screen in this movie. But for me, myself, personally, I am a fourth generation Japanese American. I am not reflected by this story at all, even though it is told through the eyes of an Asian American woman going into this very, very zany, crazy rich world of Singapore. But I felt so moved the first time I saw it. I wept just from the sheer force of seeing Asian faces being able to be normalized and tell, you know, the same kinds of glitzy, glamorous Hollywood rom-com stories that, you know, we historically have never been able to.
And you're a hard-bitten newspaper reporter to have that response. Just kidding. We'll continue with Jen Yamato. With us on Film Week, we're talking about the effect of Crazy Rich Asians, the history that the film is making, and the hopes for it as well. If you want to weigh in on it with our critics and with Jen, we're at 866-893-KPCC. If you're listening live Friday, back in a minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We just kept talking through the break there, and Justin Chang saying he's so glad he finally gets to talk with Jen about this. And of course, this has been a big conversation among people working in entertainment and among Asian American Angelenos. The movie is Crazy Rich Asians. It opened on Wednesday. It's gotten tremendous reviews. The expectations financially are big for the romantic comedy. Justin Chang, LA Times film critic, Jen Yamato, film reporter for the Times. You heard Jen's thoughts. Were they similar for you? Did you have the emotional response she did when you first saw it?
I think I did. And it's weird that the emotion comes in weird places sometimes. I mean, you could say that this is another just Cinderella fantasy, but how many of those have you seen where they take a tour of this mouthwatering, you know, night market in Singapore, you know, where there's amazing food, or, you know, when you hear like the standard kind of princessy makeover montage, but it's set to this Cantonese pop cover of Material Girl. It's like little touches. It's like, it's not just about narrative. It's like about images and textures that you see. And, you know, as I said, you know, before, you know, when Christy and I were reviewing the movie, it's like Michelle Yeoh's performance and what she says. I mean, just the kind of the cultural weight of what she's saying and the ideas being raised about individualism versus family. You don't hear that stuff all that much, I think, when you're watching movies. And so this is why I think it's not just about tokenism, and it's not just, you know, none of us wants to just, you know, support this movie or like this movie just because it is a milestone, although it is that. I think there is this freshness that you get when you inject a familiar, very accessible story with different faces and different sensibilities. I mean, it makes something that's old very new again.
Well, and one of the many times that I cry in this movie, which I've seen now three times, is a moment that has nothing to do with representation. It is the most heart-stoppingly gorgeous wedding scene that I've seen in movies. It's a moment that is the sheer power of the Hollywood romance. You know, that kind of movie that I always loved growing up. And so to me, they're just effective movie moments.
They're effective movie moments. And I think it also points out an actual deficiency, a way in which Hollywood has not been serving movie-going audiences of any background of late, which is glamour. There is these actors incarnate glamour and style in a way that I just don't think we typically see in any movies, whoever's in it. So that's a really refreshing thing.
I was fascinated, too, by the female gaze here with these gorgeous shirtless men. Oh, my God. We don't ordinarily see Asian men depicted as hot, sexy sex symbols.
No, we don't.
Or shirtless outside of like a martial arts film. No, the camera lingers on these men, and it should. Why not?
And my understanding is that one of the two Crow screenwriters, Adele Lim, who was brought in to work with Peter Chiarelli, who wrote movies like The Proposal, you know, romantic comedies like The Proposal. Adele Lim came on, and so they are co-screenwriters. And one of the things that everybody credits to Adele, who is actually born and raised in Malaysia and is Asian American, is that she accepts credit for the female gaze of which you speak, Christy. And she says, "You're welcome."
Let's take a call from Paul in Hollywood. You're on Air Talk.
Hey there. I just want to say that with the release of Crazy Rich Asians, as an Asian American actor who's been at the game for 8 years, this is really exciting. And I'm excited about the prospects for me, my friends who I've seen struggling in the business for so long. You know, I think this is a huge deal.
Paul, have you been able to be cast in major productions during your 8 years in the business?
I have. I've been cast in major network television stuff, but, you know, nothing on this level. The great thing about Crazy Rich Asians is that you see, you know, a plethora of types. You know, you see your leading men. You see goofy characters in Jimmy O Yang's character. You see gay Asian men, too. You know, you see everything. It's not just any one specific stereotype. We're all of them.
Hey, Paul, thank you so much and the very best with your career. Hopefully this opens many more doors as you're describing. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley posts on our Film Week page, "Didn't we think the Joy Luck Club would be a similar game changer? Ultimately, it wasn't. What makes us think Crazy Rich Asians will be different?" Jen?
A couple things. If you go back to press interviews that were written or features that were written at the time of Joy Luck Club, it is extremely depressing because 25 years ago, the cast of Joy Luck Club said things like, "Oh, man, I really feel like this is going to change things for Hollywood. I really hope that, you know, after Joy Luck Club comes out, we'll have more representation, more opportunities for Asian and Asian American talent." And clearly that didn't really happen until very recently on a sort of a larger studio network scale. But I do think that Crazy Rich Asians is going to build on, as I said, something that started even with Black Panther and Wonder Woman. You know, there are these big studio movies that are some of the most expensive movies being made in Hollywood. And it took this long, but I think progress can be made much faster after this point. But it will take commercial successes.
I do think it's important, too, and I understand this, you know, as our listener Paul said, from an employment standpoint, that's important. But artistically, I do think it's important not to overlook some of the so-called art house or independent films that are done with Asian actors, Asian writers and directors. I mean, Justin Lin's Better Luck Tomorrow. I mean, there have been outstanding films. I'm by no means arguing there are enough of them, but it's important in this all this attention on a big studio film that we don't forget there is great art by Asian Americans, featuring Asian Americans, and they deserve support.
And there's actually another new indie coming out called Searching, starring John Cho, which is centered around an Asian American father, but his Asian identity has nothing to do with the story, which is really great.
We're going to review that next week on Film Week, so we'll look forward to that. Justin, I want to come back. You get your sense of this about, you know, this versus previous supposed door openers.
Well, I would say that one of the things that, you know, there's when you have a gap like that, it's exciting for this movie because so much anticipation and so many expectations are placed on it. And that's also what's kind of terrible about it, because it's, and people, you know, Jen has said, you know, this is not her story. This isn't my story. This is not a story that many of us can relate to, in the sense that most of us are not, you know, hobnobbing with Singaporean royalty. You know,
yes.
So, and
yes.
That is, and I think it's unfortunate. I've already seen some of the reaction. There's this expectation that this movie has to be all things to all people. I mean, it is admittedly titled Crazy Rich Asians. And so it seems as though it's casting this wide umbrella, although that Crazy Rich is an awfully big qualifier here. So I think some people are going to take this movie for task for being, you know, superficial, or for showing isn't it so frivolous to spend time with these obscenely wealthy people? Why didn't, you know, you make your, you know, and people have already started questioning the representation of even Singapore. And that is an absolutely a valid thing.
Protested how it's depicted.
Well,
I think a lot of people,
and there's, you know, the kind of the Chinese Singaporean, you know, majority who, you know, kind of experienced their own kind of, you know, their equivalent of our white privilege, perhaps, you know. And so what about, you know, Southeast and South Asian folks in Singapore who are not represented? And I think that's a very valid thing. And yet I think the movie can be a step forward in some ways and also maybe not as much of a step forward in others. And that contradiction just has to be acknowledged.
All right. Well, it looks like it's on pace to have a tremendous success. Jen, the box office projections are very strong so far.
Oh, yes. It's around $30 million earlier this week.
Romantic comedy. That's a lot of money.
It's great. And so much of that has to do with the groundswell of support in the community and the fandom, but also the awareness that audiences have now that if they want more stories to be told with diverse and inclusive characters and talent, they have to come out to support them.
And many are, with multiple showings, like yourself. Jen Yamato, thanks so much. Film reporter for the LA Times. Justin Chang, her colleague at the Times, where he's film critic, and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and What the Flick. Have a great weekend.